Regular listeners to this podcast will know I have issued a plethora of special editions, all as part of Millions Missing and ME Awareness Weeks. I've had some lovely guests on, some really sensational people who give really important narratives surrounding myalgic encephalomyelitis, and my guest on today's podcast is no exception to that. What's so special about her is she has defined herself, and she is defined as a writer, she's a published author, as a campaigner, and as someone who has launched and is running their own charity. What hasn't defined her and what she hasn't let define her is her severe ME. However, that is what, in part, we're going to be discussing today. I'm very excited to have on Jessica Taylor Bierman. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We met at Millions Missing last year in 2018, and we sort of struck up a little friendship then, and I'm really excited to have you on, so thank you.
Thank you.
So you released this fantastic but also heartbreaking book last year, A Girl Behind Dark Glasses, which we will get on to and get into later on. But as I said in the introduction, the kind of thrust of this is, for me, severe ME today, because it is, it's really difficult because ME is atrociously misunderstood as it is, but severe ME is even less understood, and it there's so many misconceptions surrounding it. So to start off, Jess, I want you to describe, if you can, to the listeners in your own words, what is severe ME? What for you defines it, and what are the most difficult aspects of this form of the disease?
I think severe ME is defined through the fact that it literally affects every aspect of your life. You can't at times communicate, because that in itself is an exhaustion. You can't get out of the bed, you can't get out of the house, you know, it's relentless, and you can never get away from the suffering. It's a constant problem that is a vicious circle, because anything you do, it becomes effect. The ME affects that. The severity of the ME affects that. So, you know, I'm in a lot of pain. So, normally, if I was, even if I had mild ME, you know, you could do something to distract yourself from that pain, but doing anything causes more suffering. So it's literally just a living hell.
No, I can absolutely imagine. And you're right, this the vicious circle thing is sort of one of the most upsetting things about the disease, because whatever you try and do, you then just it's you try and take one step forward and you're 20 steps back again, aren't you? It's very, very distressing, in my opinion, and there's so many people out there living with it. And as you quite rightly point out, you don't get to hear them because they are so ill. It's again, we're back to a vicious circle again. But you have been raising, I want to say profile, it's not really the right word, but you've been raising the profile of severe ME, and you did it most poignantly and, in my opinion, most effectively through the book you wrote, which was A Girl Behind Dark Glasses. There will be a link in the show notes to that book, listeners. Why did you decide to do it? Because obviously, for listeners who don't know, it's an amalgamation of diary entries over a certain period of your time. Why did you decide to go ahead and do that and publish it?
I think it was really important to publish A Girl Behind Dark Glasses, because when I was suffering at that point, so I was in hospital, it's over the 4 years that I was in hospital constantly, and to everyone else, I just disappeared off the face of the earth. You know, I wasn't able to have visitors very often, so, and when they did come, they couldn't get anything out of me because I couldn't communicate, and I lost who I was. And I think having an identity through severe ME is quite a difficult thing, you know. And I wanted to get across what it was like to suffer so severely, but I wanted it to stop what happened to me happening to someone else. So, you know, there's abuse, there's just the way you're treated is quite appalling. And if I could stop that from happening to another person by educating them, then that for me was the most important thing. And also, I had to hold on to something. So I was so ill, but I had to have hope, you know, and that was so important to me. And for me, I always wanted to write a book. So that literally kept me going, because even on the worst days where I could say like a word, I still had something from that day that I had recorded down. It was really important as well to feel like I wasn't just letting life continue on without me. And so it had a purpose, you know, and I think that's really important, because it's so easy to lose hope and lose that, the fact that you can get better at all, or like improve at all, you know. And but interestingly, if I took myself back to that time now, I don't think I would realize quite how much it would take to improve, you know. Like, it's in my teenage mind, because I was only a teenager, you know, I would get better and be able to travel the world and do my own thing, because I never knew that ME was something that affected you for your life. You know, my parents didn't tell me that because they didn't want me to give up. And that was really important. And I actually feel like if I'd known how hard it was to make any improvements, you know, I think it would have affected my mental health a bit more, you know, just coping with the absolute hell it is, you know, every day is relentless.
So, I'm interested, I'm going to go slightly off script here. So do you think it was a good thing that your sort of parents didn't give you the full horror story of what was actually going on at that time for you? Do you think that was a good thing in the end?
In the end, I think it was a good thing, because I remained optimistic, and I suppose if I was back to being 14 now, I would need someone's story to kind of hold on to, like some hope, you know. And I literally hadn't heard of ME when I got ill, and I didn't know what was about, what could happen. So immediately I just thought, well, I'll get better over time, you know. And that was really, it was a really interesting way of doing it, because now I know the reality rather than what I was actually processing and thinking in my mind. So 13 years on, I now know what that it's obviously more of a lifelong condition, and I deal with it a lot differently than I would have done if I just thought I was going to get better, you know. And that was, I think for me, it was really important to kind of keep dreaming, you know. I didn't give up on that.
That's really interesting. I think that's fascinating and a sort of very important aspect, because one of the hardest things for many people with ME is coming to terms with the fact that they may not ever get better, and dealing with that aspect of things. So that's really interesting. I just want to touch on something else actually as well, because I think it's important for listeners to understand this. Before you developed court, whatever your preferred terminology is, before you got ME, you were extremely active. You're a normal teenager, weren't you? Just describe how you were before all this horror was unleashed on you.
I was a bundle of energy. I literally did not stop. I had friends, family, I was doing things all the time. And I think that was what was so difficult to get used to, is that complete change. And, you know, I was 14 when I got ill, and I didn't want to be ill. So I was very independent. I didn't like relying on people. I liked to find out things for myself. And so I didn't tell people that I was feeling unwell. I'd got a flu virus which had made me, like, every time you stood up, you'd collapse and go dizzy and collapse. And that was what got me ill. But the virus sort of went, but then I still felt ill, but I didn't want to be ill, if that makes sense. And I know it was a really naive thing to do, but we're not taught how to look after our bodies when, you know, it's like, keep calm and carry on. You know, that is literally what we grow up doing. And so I literally didn't think anything of it. And, you know, I was the type of person that I am. I was literally pushing my body to try and get it to work, you know, not understanding what was going on. But, you know, I felt like there was nothing more I could do other than fight it, you know, and I'm naturally someone who fights things. And really that was my downfall. But yeah, I think the person that I am literally now, I'm starting to get a bit more of my joie de vivre. literally, that's just the type of person I was. And so, but years later, I'm starting to get that back, you know, and I just didn't have time to stay still. That was how I was before I was ill, you know, literally on the go all the time. But I just wish there had been some sort of information, because I was also quite clever, you know. I don't have it anymore. literally, my brain has had its bit. But I would have researched it, you know. I would have looked into it. But even if I had researched it, there was nothing out there for me to go for. And that is one of the reasons why I think A Girl Behind Dark Glasses is really important, because it gives an understanding to a world that's hidden.
I think it's a brilliant way of summing it up, yes. And I disagree that your brain's had its bit. Thank you, Jessica. I don't believe that or hear that for a second. So there's... like I said, I think it's really important that people know who you were before this disease ravaged you. But I think it's great, and it's also a testament to what can happen, that you're feeling you're getting some of that back now. But while you were in the sort of worst stages of the disease, as documented in The Girl Behind Dark Glasses, one of the standout most... for me, upsetting and harrowing bits of the book was when you couldn't communicate, because I was just dumbstruck, and I ironically, and it was just shocking, and I that for me would be my worst nightmare. I mean, literally not being able to talk to people at all. How did you cope with that? Because I cannot imagine being trapped like that inside your own head. How did you get through that period?
Because the weird thing was, it was the connection between my brain and my mouth. Like, I just didn't know how to speak. So at first it was the fact it was too exhausting to speak, but I was so ill at the time, like literally near enough not there, you know, and that by the time I started to not even more energy, it was more like thoughts, because I couldn't even think. That was the weirdest thing, you know. I just, the cognitive side of me was completely done, you know, and I was just suffering so badly. But over time that started to improve a bit, but by that time I literally couldn't remember how to speak. And that is difficult. That is really challenging, because I don't think all the things that happened to me, so the abuse, the way stuff spoke to me, what they would do, you know, I don't think that would happen if you had the power of speech, which is why there's a chapter in the book called The Power of Speech, because it just changes everything. And so I kept going, because I literally believed that I was writing my diary in my head, you know. And so I literally would come up with a sentence. It would take me the day to come up with a sentence. And then I would use sounds rather than actual words to record what was happening. So it felt like I was getting something out. And I think the hardest part of it was the fact that the medical profession, they decided that because I was unable to speak or I was so ill, that I must be psychiatrically ill and must be depressed, you know, and I couldn't get through to them. My parents couldn't either. They were my advocates, and they literally had fights with the hospital just to get it understood that I was still there, you know, and you lose your identity as well, you know, and the identity literally becomes ME, you know, that's there is nothing else. And I started to write like a sentence. It was a sentence a day, and literally it was my outlook. Yeah, it was everything. And in the end, they got the doctors to read that, and it was only then that they said, no, she's not depressed, you know. And I thought, well, what would happen if I couldn't have done that, you know? That's what's really scary. You know, I made myself so ill by doing that one sentence a day, but without it, I would probably be in the Maudsley now, you know, and that's the truth about the facts. And it's quite scary.
It is very scary. And I mean, I also kind of dread to think how many people are out there who didn't have that sort of strength of mind and determination that you had necessarily, who are in that position. I mean, you must have seen it on social media. There's a case of the young lady called Gigi, who's her family are fighting.
Yeah.
At the minute for her. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, because that's another shocking case. Essentially, the medical profession trying to send her down the psychiatric route, and it's quite upsetting. But I dread to think how many people are actually out there living through this. You talk about the medical profession, and in the book, I mean, in my opinion, you're quite nice about them, really. To be honest, you're quite polite. I think if I'd have been in your shoes, I would have been a lot more forceful of what I said. But you're quite balanced, really, in the book. But your treatment was horrific. It was absolutely disgusting. I mean, again, something else that stood out for me was the fact that they basically experimented on you with a load of energy drinks to see if that would make you better. I mean, it's just, I read that and I was like, is this for real? They actually tried this on her. And it's just, it was staggering to read. I mean, after everything you went through during that period, how, or have you, maintained trust in the medical profession? Because it must have been so, so demoralising, and also just a complete loss of faith in them. How have you maintained any form of trust from that experience?
I think it's very hard to have a trust for the medical profession. I suppose in some ways I've grown up with a medical family. My dad's a paramedic. My mom used to be a nurse. And so medicine had always been something that was in my life. I never took medicine, but as in, it's always talked about, you know. And so I had a respect for the medical profession, which is why I always had to find the positive in what they were doing, you know, because I couldn't bring myself to understand that they were actually playing with my life like they really were. And I suppose it was a coping mechanism as well, because you're in their mercy, you know. You are literally in their hands. They can do anything, and you know, you could die, you know. It's as simple as that. And I mean, one of the times that really affected me, and I thought, you know, this is really, really bad, you know, was when they put me on a drug, amitriptyline, and my body didn't metabolize it. And so they never checked my bloods or anything. They just kept up in the dose. And then suddenly I had a lump on my arm that was noticed, and they wouldn't let my parents come in to see me very much. I was only allowed like 5 minutes with my dad because they thought I didn't have the energy to see him. And that was traumatic enough as it is. But the nurses, they basically saw this lump and they freaked. And then they felt my pulse and my heart was completely irregular and off the scales, going incredibly fast. And it had a lot of ectopic beats. And suddenly it went from having a nurse in here to like five doctors, a consultant, all the nurses, the sisters and everything. And they finally did my blood. This was like 2 months after I'd started the medication. And literally, once they had checked the blood, they freaked, you know, because they were just like, we nearly killed you, you know. It was as simple as that, you know. And because I didn't have a voice, again, going back to the communication, because I couldn't say anything, I relied on them to know when something was wrong. So, you know, it put me in a position. I'm always scared of doctors. Because in hospital for so long, I felt like it was judgment day when they came round, you know, and literally you had to, well, particularly one hospital I was under, you had to have improved a bit. If you hadn't improved a bit, they would shout at you. And it was just as simple as that. That's how they were, you know, and I have had problems with doctors ever since, you know. I find it very difficult to put my trust in them because I just know what happened to me before. But I find myself petrified of them. You know, I'm petrified they're just going to say, you know, it's psychiatric, that I'm putting it on or whatever. I'm just petrified of it. And really, I have to say, neurologists I struggle with, you know, I really do struggle with them because it was a neurologist that was I was under that used to shout at me and be really horrendous. And you know, this was that meant to be a place of excellence for ME back in 2006 2007, yeah, so you know, it was meant to be a place that would help you, you know. And yeah, I think it's affected the way I trust the medical profession in a whole, you know. And I am very careful with what I say to them. But actually, last year, I saw a neurologist and he actually believed me, you know. And it was so surprising, you know. You go in there thinking you're gonna have to fight your corner again, and he was like, no, you know. And he completely understood. But when I put that onto my blog, The World of One Room, you know, there wasn't another person who had said they'd had a good experience with neurologists. And I'm like up to 7,000 people on The World of One Room, and it just staggers me that we have that problem, you know. But I think for me, the worst ones were the neurologists.
That's a fascinating insight. And in mine and Nicola's experience, yeah, it's very interesting, actually, that quite often the people we have had most issue with have been neurologists. It's sort of slightly different backstory there, which I won't get into. But yeah, you summed it up for me, and it makes me angry when you said you're very careful what you say to them. I mean, it's such a ridiculous position to be in that you have to think ahead and be slightly guarded when you go and see a medical profession. But as I mean, the negligence and the abuse that you and thousands of other people, millions of other people across the world have suffered, it's of little wonder. And I mean, that's a whole nother podcast in itself, talking about that, because there's a real major problems with the medical profession. But it's a damning indictment to what happened to you that you still have those trust issues. I mean, in terms of sort of the medical side of things, at the extreme and most harrowing end of ME is, of course, people do end up dying from it. I mean, in this country, there's only ever been two people who have had ME recorded as the cause of death on their death certificates. One of the most recent was, of course, Meryn Crofts, wonderful young lady who sadly passed away. She had severe ME. There was obviously complications as well from that. But, I mean, reading A Girl Behind Dark Glasses, your ME was extremely, extremely severe at points. Did it ever cross your mind that this could be it for you, that the sort of hospital four walls might be the last thing you see?
I think, yes, it did come to me. I mean, my parents were taken to the side and told, you know, to spend time with me because that was it, really. And I think they were told that about 6 or 7 times, you know. So at first I was a bit naive to it. I didn't know what was going on. I was so ill. I just wanted it to stop, you know. But yeah, so I kept believing that I would fight it and I would get better, you know, because that is just how I had to be. That mentality, I honestly believe, and it's not about having a positive mental attitude, but if I hadn't had that hope, there would have been nothing to keep me going, you know, because literally I had nothing. I had the amount of nothing, it almost brings a whole new meaning to the word nothing, you know, like nothing's wrong, you know, but literally when you are completely succumbed to this illness, you know, it's demoralizing, you know, and you have to keep going, you have to have some form of hope, you know, and it's so, so challenging. And, you know, interestingly, after I came out of hospital for the 4 years, because obviously A Girl Behind Dark Glasses is literally the first 4 years, but I actually had very severe ME for much longer than that, which meant I was in and out of hospital. And I have to say, I've said this to other people, you know, I actually found it harder once I'd come home and I was in and out of hospital for the next like 3 years. I was in and out of hospital with major complications. I actually could not cope with being in a hospital or being that ill. And I don't know how I kept going in the 4 years that I was in hospital. I literally now, I just don't, I have no words as to say how I did it, because I just think it was my life, you know. And I know that sounds really blasé, you know, but it's literally, I had nothing else. I couldn't do anything else. But what I found was when I came home to the community, to my home, I suddenly had things that reminded me of home, you know, my family were around, and I didn't see them all the time, but they were there, you know. I knew that I had that comfort. And then when I was taken from there and put back into hospital, I couldn't cope with it, you know. And it was really hard because the ME would go crazy and et cetera, and all the sensitivities, and it drove me mad, you know. And that's the thing, you know, because you're so ill, it drives you to a point of you're holding on with everything you have, and that's all you can do. And I have a friend, you know, who her phrase is keep swimming, you know, just got to keep swimming. But literally, when she has her moments when she goes into hospital, she said, no, not keep swimming, just keep floating. And that's the thing, you know, it's surviving. You're not living. You are literally just surviving the second. And it takes every second to get to that place, you know. But interestingly, I've had too many times where it's been too close, you know, to not making it. And I literally don't know why I'm any different. And I have to say, because I'm lucky enough that I have improved. And I honestly, and I think people struggle to understand why, but I have survivor's guilt. I don't understand how I could have improved a bit, whereas my friend Meryn passed away from it, and she had the same severity as me, you know, and that is a reality check, you know, because suddenly you're hearing someone else who didn't have the same you know, they had exactly what you had, but they couldn't get better, you know. And I find it hard to know the reason why I did.
No, absolutely. And that's beautifully put. And that is one of the most heartbreaking things about this illness, is because it affects everyone differently. There's no way you can compare often two people. And it's what's in part, I think, making research and answers to this so difficult. But you did get through it. And as you say, you kept hope. And as I said in the introduction, your severe ME has not defined you, even though, and I can well imagine that the time you spent in hospital, it was all about the ME and there was literally nothing else. But that hasn't completely tarnished your life. As I said in the introduction, you're a published author, you have your charity, and never mind a royal baby, you are now with child, of course, which will be the most important birth for me of the next period of time. And you have come through this, and as you say, you are improving with time. I mean, with all that going on, with a little bump in your belly as well, how are you feeling about the future now? Are we? You must be feeling more hopeful than you already were.
Yeah. So, as I say, I'm very lucky. I have a very supportive husband. Literally, without him, I don't think it would have been possible. You know, just to have any of the improvements that I've made. I would never say they were down to someone else, you know, like, I know that sounds, I've had people say, oh no, you just having the focus of having someone like a man with you or whatever, it must have helped you get better. I was like, no, I have always wanted to get better, you know. No one can make me want to get better any more than I want to get better myself. But yeah, you know, I think becoming pregnant, I literally feared how people would take it a lot. I really did. And I thought it's a really difficult subject because, of course, you know, literally I've always wanted to be a mum, but I never thought it would be possible. I wrote a blog on it and I just said, you know, it's, you know, with everything that I go through, I don't know how it can change, you know. And so it's been an uplifting thing, but it's also a huge pressure, you know, and I put pressure on myself anyway, you know. But literally there's so much to contend with. And I also want to be really mindful of people who have severe ME, whatever, you know, who feel they can't have a child, you know, and that it's a very grey subject. And I just am very mindful about respecting those people because, you know, I was there once, you know, and I feel very conscious about that. But yeah, I am hopeful. I mean, I made quite a lot of improvements with the pregnancy hormone that I never knew that could even happen. But apparently autoimmune diseases can, when they're to do with the immune system, literally the pregnancy hormone creates a kickstart for the body. And you either improve or you digress, you know, you don't get better, you know. And very luckily, I seem to improve. And yeah, it was quite surprising. But you know, I will take it every day as I can, you know, and just live as much as I can, you know. That's what's important to me, is that, you know, I can... I think in my video, I did a video called The World of One Room many years ago now. But I think even in that, I had said, you know, I will get better. I will follow my heart's desires. And, that, you know, that was what I, and randomly, I when I was in hospital, I learned to say that in Polish because of my Polish carers. They literally, I could say random stuff in Polish. But literally, I just feel like it's a new start, you know. I still have ME. I still probably have severe ME, but not as severe as I was at 0% functionability, you know, for a long, long time. And I think, you know, I blog about the subject now because I know when I found out that I was pregnant, I literally, there was no one, you know, and I was like stuck, lost, fearful, you know, everything under the sun. And yeah, so I'm very mindful about giving enough information, but not overwhelming people with information, you know, because I know how difficult it is.
No, I think your approach is absolutely spot on, and I think you will be fine. You're going to be a wonderful mother, I'm sure. Jess, it's so lovely to have you on the podcast, and what you see as well, and I have to say, is what listeners will not see, of course, is that I would imagine that this half hour, that's you done for the day now, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I think I put that on my Instagram stories yesterday, you know, people see me at a certain time, you know, like where I'm putting all my energy into something, but they never see the aftermath, you know. And that is the difficulty with severe ME, you know, because literally it's even more invisible than ME is, you know, in itself, because literally you can just suddenly lose it with a click of the fingers and that's is gone, you know. So yeah, I think I'll spend the rest of the day resting up.
I know. Well, rest peacefully. But Jess, you have been eloquent, you have been on point and very insightful, and like I said, it's a real pleasure to have you on. Jessica Taylor-Bierman, thank you so much for coming on the special edition of the podcast.
Thank you ever so much.